This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is for Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate, case 13. Dishan carried his bowls, the main case. Dishan one day came down to the dining room carrying his bowls. Xue Feng said, "Old master, the bell hasn't rung, the drum hasn't been struck yet. Where are you going with your bowls?" Dishan at once turned back to his room. Xue Feng told this incident to Yanto, who said, "The great master though he is, Dishan has not yet grasped the last word of Zen." Hearing of this, Dishan sent his attendant to call Yanto in and said, "Do you not approve of me?" Yanto whispered his reply to him, and Dishan was satisfied and silent. The next day, Dishan appeared on the high seat, and sure enough, his talk was different from the usual ones. Yanto came in front of the monastery, laughed heartily, clapping his hands, and says, "What a great joy it is. The old master has now grasped the last word of Zen. From now on, nobody in the world can make light of him." Woman's commentary. As for the last word of Zen, neither Yanto nor Dishan has ever heard of it, even in a dream. If I examine it carefully, they are like puppets set on a shelf. The poem. If you understand the first word, you will know the last word. The last word or the first word, it is not a word. So often on these, on the Sunday following an introductory retreat, as we've had this weekend, I give a talk on a koan that is usually very direct and not so complicated. This is a little bit more of a complicated koan that I was drawn to present today. The koan is we've been all weekend practicing meditation and various forms of practice, all of which incorporate the practice of meditation, zazen, how you use your mind, awareness, letting go, mindfulness, into each of those practices. That is the life of a practitioner, is to live the Dharma through these practices so that they become more and more your own body and mind. They become our natural way of being. And so through the history of Buddhism, there have been, beginning with the Buddha, there have been different ways of practicing meditation, practicing zazen, because the question is, what do you do with your mind? Where do you direct it? And so there are various objects that are used. The breath can be considered one of these objects. There are physical objects that are used and have been suggested in great detail what those objects are. Oftentimes that begins with an external object, like a disc, that is used to meditate on, and then at some point is brought into the mind so that it's not relying on a visual cue, if you will, but rather the power of the mind. But that takes a certain amount of development to be able to do that. There are visualization practices that exist in the Tibetan Buddhist and in the Zen tradition, in which different objects are visualized, and those objects might also be very complex. And that's part of the meditative process, is to be able to hold the complexity of that visualization in the mind. And that object sometimes is without meaning, but the object is not random, right? And so a disc is not a symbol that has meaning for the meditator, and yet that object itself and the shape of it does have significance in terms of our consciousness. other objects like a visualization of a deity or a bodhisattva or a Buddha, or an enlightened realm, does have significance, does have qualities or virtues which become part of the meditator's process and part of their consciousness and part of their being and part of their realization. The koan can be looked at in a similar kind of way, in that the student brings their attention, directs their attention to the koan, and what that koan is then determines what is that object, if you will, that the student is holding in their mind. So it might be a word, as in the koan mu. Does a dog have Buddha nature? Zhao Zhou said mu. It might be an image. What is the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming from the West? Zhao Zhou said an oak tree in the garden. It might be a question. It might be a situation. It might be a passage from a sutra. It might be an object, an inanimate object. And so the student brings that into their mind. Here, the practice with the koan is to both calm the mind, to develop samadhi, but also to gain insight, as is true with all of the different forms of meditation that we use. One of the characteristics of the koan is that it does that via a question. And sometimes that question is explicit and sometimes it's not. Sometimes the question is really just in the inquiring mind of the student, wanting to understand, wanting to realize that which sits before them. Master Shibayama, in his commentary on this, said, quoting his own teacher, said, "The task or role of the koan is to help a student open their eye and attain realization and embody that. It is a means, a skillful means in Zen training, but in actual practice, the koan doesn't lead a student along an easy and smooth shortcut like other ordinary means. The koan, on the contrary, throws a student into a steep and rugged maze where they have no sense of direction at all. They're expected to overcome all the challenges and find their way out themselves. In other words, the koan is a difficult and rough path for the student to go through. Certain koans, such as this one, are called nanto koans, which are," he says, "intricate and not rational." He says irrational. And I would disagree. I would say that they're, respectfully, I would say that they are not rational. In the same way that delusion, from a certain perspective, we can say is irrational because it continues to create suffering that we would rather be free of. But within the mind of delusion, it is very rational. Here, the koan is trying to free us of all forms of rationality, in which he says even the most brilliant intellect will lose their way. And so when he talks about the koan leading them into a steep and rugged maze, it's the student that really does that. The koan can't do that. The koan is a vehicle and has a power in and of itself, but because its power lies in our consciousness. It's not inherent in the words themselves. The words have power because of the way our consciousness works. That when our rational seeking mind, our mind that seeks to know what we already know, to see what we've already seen, to affirm what we need to be affirmed, so that we can continue on safe and secure in our knowledge of the world as unchanging, the koan does not yield to that. It says, no, you cannot enter with all of that baggage. You must set that down. Setting that down is when it becomes steep and rugged. The very act of trying to set it down is steep and rugged. And it's at that moment that we begin to encounter difficulties. And it's in that we have to find our way out. And that could be It could be a sign at the gate, right? You are welcome. We are so glad to see you. Please enter freely. You will have to find your own way out. But a lot of people would probably just would turn around, not understanding that, thinking that somehow they were going to become trapped, right? We trap ourselves, our mind. And so the koan is powerful because it arises from both the consciousness of delusion and the consciousness, the mind of enlightenment. That in a sense, it invites us in to that place that we in which we live and are entangled, and it offers us a way to discover a way out from within ourselves, which means the student has to become very intimate with the koan, which is true of all forms of practice. To see self-nature, Buddha nature, the nature of awakening. You know, the word Buddha nature in the sense of nature doesn't really figure much in the early teachings. You don't see that term, Buddha nature. It's not because Buddha nature didn't exist. A Buddha realized Buddha nature. But that as a specific phrase or teaching really came to be into prominence in China and the development of Chan. And because it resonated with the consciousness of the people who were practicing at that time and sort of really connected with that sense of inherent enlightened nature. And in looking at the etymology of nature, that the birth or the origin of the word nature is in fact birth, which is quite nice to think of self-nature as that to which we are, we possess at birth, or we're in a sense come into at birth as we take this human form, but also in practice and realization that we are in a sense birthed to, or that we give birth to our original self-nature, free of all the imposition of ideas and beliefs and desires and judgments, all of those things we have to set down in order to enter into this gateless gate. So Wuman called this collection the gateless gate. There is a gate. In fact, the first koan, Mu, the character for Mu, if you look at it, looks a lot like a prison cell, right? And so there's this sense of this gate that is difficult to enter. In the moment we enter, and in the moment that we realize self-nature, we realize from the beginning that gate was gateless. In this particular koan, and one of the reasons I wanted to use this today was because there are koans that are kind of signature koans in the sense that they teach both about the history of Zen, but also what the tradition sees as important, because that's what religious teachings are. Or in a sense, every story is not just telling about what happened, it's telling what we think is important to tell about what happened. And so some stories are more significant for what they don't tell. And so here, Dashan was an 8th and 9th century teacher who was very well known in his time. And his coming into his place as a teacher is significant because he was originally a scholar of Buddhism and was said to have been an expert on the Diamond Sutra, which is a seminal teaching of the Mahayana tradition. And he heard, and then he lived in the north, and he heard about this tradition, this Chan tradition in the south, which basically was teaching that the transmission of the Dharma is outside of scriptures, doesn't rely on words and letters. And he took some offense at that, being a person of words and letters. And so he figured he was going to go down and set them straight. So he carries down all of his, this is the story. So he carries down all of his texts and his commentaries with which to do battle and save the day. And he encounters a wise woman on the road who asks him a simple question based in that teaching of which he was an expert. She said, "It says in that sutra that your past mind, your present mind, and your future mind are all ungraspable. And he says, yes, that is so. And she says, as she's selling him a cake, she says, with which mind will you eat this cake? And he couldn't respond. And so that threw him into a deep state of doubt, of self-doubt, right? Because here his expertise did not help him with this very direct question. And so he sought out a teacher, and he came to enlightenment with that teacher, in which he himself saw the limitation of knowledge. And so that's one of the reasons this story is significant. It's because it's saying here was a person who was deeply schooled, deeply understood in terms of knowledge, the Dharma, and yet that was not able to actually bring him into a state of ease, into a state of liberation. And so it's really a demonstration of the limits of knowledge. And that in order for him to come to realization, he needed to leap free of all that he knew. And having then completed his training, he went on to become a very well-known teacher and was considered to be a very fierce teacher. And this is an important part of the story, is that he was very demanding and very yielding. And there are different kinds of teachers. There are teachers who are very gentle. Zhao Zhou seemed to have been a very gentle teacher, used live words. Other teachers who are very fierce and demanding. There's a story that Zhui Feng, one of Deshan's teachers, and who's also in this, Koan came to Deshan and said, can I understand the great teachings of the ancients or not? And Deshan struck him and said, what? And Zhui Feng said, I don't understand. And Deshan walked away. And the next day, Zhui Feng came to him again for instructions. And Deshan said, look, my teaching has neither words nor phrases. It's actually without a dharma that I can give to you. And at that, Zhui Feng came to realization. And when another Yanto, Zhui Feng's elder brother, dharma elder brother, heard about this, he said, old Deshan's backbone was as hard as iron. It couldn't be bent. Even so, within his Dharma gate, there are quite a few who study and realize this. And so this is important because he was known to be a very demanding, fierce teacher. And so one day he comes down, and he's now at the very, very end of his life. He's very elderly. He's very mature. And he comes down, and Shui Feng and Yanto are two of his students. And they're also close to each other. And so Deshan comes down carrying his orioki for the meal. And Shui Feng, who's the cook, turns around and says, what are you doing, old man? He said, we haven't rung the bell. The drum hasn't sounded, right? We're not ready yet. And it says Deshan just turned around and went back to his room. And so that's the first part of the koan. What is that? And so part of the study of the koan is to see what is essential and what is not. We might pass by that and see that as a simple, unremarkable moment. And we would miss something. As Zhui Feng missed something. And so the koan is to enter into the mind of Deshan in that very moment. To enter into the mind of Zhui Feng. Turning back this very revered teacher with a simple remark. What's going on there? Deshan was a master of many years of rigorous practice. Why did he just turn back? There's another student where the national teacher calls out to his student, attendant. And the attendant says, yes, master. Attendant, yes, master. Attendant, yes, master. What is that mind? This is not being passive. It's not being repetitious. When we think about the mind of impatience, of expectation, of schedules, of demanding, of wanting, of irritation, the mind of what about me? Deshan could have very easily, you know, had a different response to this young student. Xuefeng could not yet see this mind that was on vivid display. He could not see the fruit of these many, many years of practice in Deshan. He couldn't yet appreciate what he had just encountered. You know, we particularly in our culture, I mean, probably in all cultures, you know, we look for the dazzle, right? For the bright lights, for the flashing lights, for... And here was this old teacher, right? It's like in the 10th Oxherding picture downstairs. You know, at the end of the journey, there's this old practitioner, right? Sort of disheveled, dirty, stumbling along. What is their brilliance? What is brilliance when the shine of the brilliance has all worn away? What's left? Kazan Zenji said, though clear waters range to the vast blue autumn sky, how can that compare with the hazy moon on a spring night? Most people want to have pure, bright, penetrating clarity. But sweep as you will, you cannot empty the mind. What is this hazy moon that Kazan speaks of? And so we stop. We turn around. We look. We see. We let our concerns rest. You know, it's like anybody who has highly developed any art, any field of understanding, any knowledge, any art form, any craft, can see in someone else where they're at, right? It's part of what comes with understanding. It's part of what comes with experience and maturity, right? Because it's on display. And so what do we see in Deshan? What do we see in Xuefeng? And so Xuefeng was kind of pumped up a little bit about this. He sent the old man back to his room. And so he goes to his Dharma brother, Yanto, and told him about it. And Yanto says, yeah, great master, though, the old man is. He hasn't yet realized the last word of Zen. Right? What's that? And so that gets around, as you might imagine. Right? It travels through at the speed of light. And typically, Deshan would be the last one to know, right? So he hears about it, finally. And he calls to Yanto, calls him in and says, don't you approve of me? And Yanto leans down and whispers to him, why? They're alone. Why does he whisper it to him? What do we know? Why is this important? And so part of the coming from the mind of delusion, part of the koan's work is to trap us. But the koan doesn't do that. The koan just presents a simple situation. Where do we get entangled? And so part of the practice is to free the mind of all projections, of all complications, of all contrivance. How do you bring an authentic, bare, clear mind into this moment, this simple moment? Because we're you know, meaning-making machines. Our mind loves to make meaning of things. So inevitably, when the student is working on this koan, there are all kinds of theories and elaborate schemes about what's going on, right? The student knows what Yanto is saying to him and tells me in vivid detail. But that's not it. That's just what we always do. We see something and we believe we know. We see a person's face. We see the way somebody dresses. We see two people interacting. And we come to all kinds of conclusions about what's happening. And so what is the reality before the eyes? Just this. It's like walking into a room of intrigue and not being deceived. Walking into a room of history and not being deceived, which doesn't mean that we know everything. There may be much that we don't know. But if not, what does it mean to not be deceived? What does it mean to not deceive oneself? How do we see other people's business without being deceived in other people's business? How do we see our own business and not be deceived by our own business? So Dashan was satisfied. And the next day, sure enough, when he got up to give a Taisho, it was different than before. How is it different? What's going on? And so the student needs to enter into this. Now this can be seen as, and as students often say, and it seems as even women are saying, if I examine it carefully, they're like puppets on a shelf. And so typically a student will say, well, this is just a whole drama, right? This is just a drama to help Xue Feng come to realization, right? So the old man, Dashan and Yantou are working together and they're orchestrating this thing and it's just like a play. And that is the view from the audience. But isn't it time we stop being the audience? Have we not had enough of that? How is this talk different? There is the conceptual mind. There are conscious thoughts. There is our karma. There are projections. All moving in pursuit of something desired. And then there's the mind at rest, the mind that is not seeking, that is not dull, the mind that is free of ideas and desires, is even free of aspiration, is free of attaining and not attaining. And so Yantou gets up at the end of the Taisho and claps his hands and says, what a great joy it is. Finally, the old man has grasped the last word of Zen. Now, nobody can make light of him. Shibayama speaks about this last word as an ultimate word, the absolute essence. More words. Are these the last words? What is the last word? That word that is the final word encapsulates, completes, in which nothing is left out. Everything is seen. The last word. Shibayama says almost parenthetically, I suppose it has to be asked, is there really a so-called last word or not? And so the student going into this koan will inevitably set about to find this last word. What is it? Which indeed, if we don't seek it, how will we find it? In seeking it, though, how will we find it? That is the great challenge. If we do not seek Buddha nature, we will never discover it. In seeking it, how will we ever discover it? And so Shimayama says, Yantou, Toksan, Xue Feng, the Buddha, they've never heard of it, even in a dream. Then why are we talking about it? What does it mean to have never heard about it? And lest we think that this is just a lot of wordplay, we should remember the evening gatha, because these people never forgot it. Dashan was living in life and death are of supreme importance. He's not interested in futzing around, wasting people's time, his time, living as though we're going to live forever. It's not wordplay. It's not a puzzle. It's not something to just keep you off the streets and doing Zazen, which I have heard people claim koans are about. Usually within the depth of their frustration. This is all just a hoax. There is no resolution. There's no realization. This is just a way to keep me on the cushion. And my response is, really? You think that's what all of us would be devoting ourselves to? What is this last word? And so the student has to want to know, has to ask with their whole being, pure inquiry. And this is one of the great powers of the koan, is how do you ask without knowing? With the complete confidence that you can see this. Because you're a Buddha. Because you have Buddha nature. And because you have consciousness. And because you're here. You have the perfect capacity to understand, to realize this for yourself. And so we have to sit with that confidence, that faith, and without knowing. And so how do you ask a question without already having something in front of you? How do you enter into a situation? How do you wake up to the day and know what your day's plan and yet not put all of that in front of you as though we're prophets? One ultimate absolute asking without knowing, without seeking, ultimately without even asking. And so we might wonder, what does this have to do with my life, my home, my relationships, my challenges, this world? Is any of this outside of mind? Is any of this outside of your own experience? What do you call home? What do you call family? What do you call the world? When you think of these things, when you speak of them, what are they? When you think of yourself, what are you? Not who are you, because that already presumes you must be someone. What are you? In a sense, the koan is seizing upon this most incredible part of human consciousness, which is our examining mind. We want to know. We want to understand. Right? It's like when you wake up, you know, deep in a sleep and you don't know where you are. You know that feeling? And before anything else happens, we have to orient. Where am I? Right? And we can see that as a very, you know, sort of just immediate spatial thing, but we could also look at that in a much larger existential way. Where am I? I'm alive, I'm living, I'm in this life, but where am I? I'm doing things, I'm moving in some direction, but where? And so that examining mind has given rise to everything. I mean, just think of the history of us, the Industrial Revolution, information technology, social media, biotechnology, artificial intelligence. You know, we're so good at making stuff, creating things, being like gods, but we're not always so good at knowing how to use what we make. Do we know what we're doing? Do we know why we're making this? Do we need this? Right? We don't vote on this stuff. And yet much of it is much more powerful than what we do vote on. What is power? The Buddha said, your thoughts, your words, your actions. That's your seat of power. To create heaven and to create hell. To bind and to liberate. What is the last word? Dongshan said about this, another master replying to this said, I am always most sincere right here. I think we could all just take that and take that in deeply and study that. I am always most sincere right here. As woman says in the poem, you can, if you understand the first word, you'll know the last word. But after all, first word, last word, it isn't a word. This knowing is not knowledge. It's not information. It's not truth. It's not Dharma. It's not worldly, but it's not apart from the world. It's not a relationship, but it's not outside of relationships. We are so much more than just getting stuff done. You know, we wake up to tasks, the details of our life, right? Moment for moment, taking care of things, attending to things, doing things, making things, using things. But within all of it, where are we? What are we? What is this? It seems human beings have never been satisfied alone with just getting stuff done, although we do get a lot of stuff done. And in that, we also get a lot of stuff undone. I remember there was a resident years ago who had a certain kind of energy, very fast, very sort of assertive. And he was very willing to jump in and take care of stuff. And in whatever we gave him to, it's like, can you repair this? Can you fix this? Because he was good with his hands. He would fix that one thing and break like two other things. And then he would hide those things. And I thought, yeah, that kind of sums it up. That's sort of like a metaphor for all of us. What is a path? What is this path? I am always most sincere right here. That is the path. Dongshan is speaking from he was also a very, very mature being. He was speaking from a place of deep, deep knowing. We think of sincerity, you know, we can understand sincerity on so many levels. You know, just be truthful. Just mean it. Yes, by all means. He is speaking from a very deep place. I am most sincere. There is nothing inauthentic. There is nothing that remains outside of this, right here. And that sincerity is another expression of our Buddha nature, of our enlightened nature, which, by the way, transcends Buddhism. We speak of it as Buddha nature because we're practicing within Buddhism. But Buddhism, Buddha, is ultimately not about Buddhism. It's about human lives. It's always been that way. It will always be that way. So to go to that place of sincerity, which is more than words, more than just getting stuff done, so that we can celebrate and rejoice in our language, in the power of language, which is magic, and in all the things that make up our day, right? Which are blessings, and not experience them as burdens, obstacles. And so, what is this last word? We have to find our way in to the seat, to the source, to the heart of the matter. So I'll end with a poem. So many miles, so many paths, only to see certainty after certainty turn to dust. The confidence and resolve of today is not like that of yesterday. Though the fire still has embers, the flames no longer offend. First word, last word. Have you seen the tiny new beech leaves hanging their heads so weakly? Ah, they steal my breath away.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.